us until that light has shone in us. And we recognize as well that if your light is to shine in us, it will happen as we open ourselves to your word. And your word just shines that light into our lives. So we do pray that as we turn to your word now, by the power of your Holy Spirit, you will give us grace to receive what you have to say to us, and that through your word you will be changing us to be the people through whom your light can shine into this dark world. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
So, it may have come as a bit of a surprise to you to be reminded tonight that there's a general election coming up. Just 18 more days. 19 days' time, it'll all be over. And somebody will be running the country. He said with extreme enthusiasm. So there are just 18 more days for the various parties to persuade us that they are indeed the best to govern this country. And so over the last week, we've had this constant stream of party manifestos hitting the airwaves. So now we know that the Tories will turn all failing schools into academies. The Lib Dems are going to build 300,000 new homes a year. Labour will freeze energy bills. UKIP will cut foreign aid by $9 billion a year. And everybody's going to protect the NHS. I did actually see one clip where people were asked to identify which party had come up with certain policies. And in several cases, they couldn't tell. Because, let's face it, all the parties are telling us what they think we want to hear. But what about us? What should be the priorities which Christians look for in party manifestos? You may have seen in the news, the House of Bishops of the Church of England caused quite a stir a few weeks ago by publishing a pastoral letter challenging all the political parties with a fresh moral vision of the kind of country we want to be. Unsurprisingly, there were moans from some people about the church meddling in politics. But at least the bishops had tried to set out an alternative agenda. And actually, over these next few Sunday evenings, we're going to be looking at some of the issues they highlighted. Not just because a bunch of bishops said it, but actually because as God's people, we really do need to take some time to figure out what is on God's manifesto for society. And there is a real challenge in doing that, actually, because the vast majority of the Bible is actually addressed to God's people rather than to society as a whole. So much that we read in the Old Testament is addressed to the people of Judah and Israel, God's chosen people who were meant to be living as his people, rather than to the pagan countries around. But still, it gives us a picture of what God's ideal society, God's good society, would look like. And so it is kind of relevant to our country, as well as to the church. And we're starting tonight with the issue of wealth and poverty. Of course, it is a huge issue internationally. Almost half the world population, 3 billion people, live on less than around £1.50 a day. According to UNICEF, 22,000 children die each day due to poverty. Almost 30% of children in the developing world are underweight or stunted. Some 1.1 billion people in the developing world have inadequate access to water. 2.6 billion lack basic sanitation. And this is a bit out of date, but in 2004, 0.13% of the world's population controlled 25% of the world's financial assets. So on a global scale, this is this huge issue. But it isn't just something that affects the global sort of field and countries far away. It's a real issue in our society. The Joseph Rowntree Foundation's report on poverty in the UK in 2014 says that 13 million people in the UK are living in poverty. And actually, of those, half are in working families. Of course, that all depends on how you define poverty. But the Trussell Trust report that in the year ending the 31st of March 2014, so that's just a year ago, over 900,000 people in that year visited food banks in this country. And you can set against that the fact that it's recently been reported that 10% of households in this country are now asset millionaires. Now, in a lot of cases, that means that they own houses that are worth lots and lots of money, but still, 10% of households are asset millionaires. And the richest 10% of households in this country own 850 times the total wealth of the bottom 10%. In the bishop's letter, it says, "In Britain, material inequality continues to widen." And it is obviously true. So what should our attitude to that be? What should we be looking for on this issue in the manifestos that our political parties are publishing? What's on God's manifesto? We can't define that by looking at just one passage, so there are one or two that I want to look at. But let's start with the prophet Amos. Amos chapter 6. And Carol's going to come and read part of that for us.
Amos 6, which can be found on page 922 of the Pew Bibles, chapter 6, 1-7. Woe to the complacent. Woe to you who are complacent in Zion, and to you who fear secure on Mount Samaria. You notable men of the foremost nation, to whom the people of Israel come. Go to Galmath and look at it. Go from there to Great Hamath, and then go down to Gath in Philistia. They are better off than you, they are better off than your two kingdoms. Is their land larger than yours? You put off the day of disaster and bring near a reign of terror. You lie on your beds adorned with ivory and lounge on your couches. You dine on choice lambs and fatted calves. You strum away on your harps like David and improvise on musical instruments. You drink wine by the bowlful and use the finest lotions. But you do not grieve over the ruin of Joseph. Therefore, you will be among the first to go into exile. Your feasting and lounging will end. This is the word of the Lord.
Amos was writing around 760 BC. The book of Amos begins, "The words of Amos, one of the shepherds of Tekoa, the vision he saw concerning Israel 2 years before the earthquake, when Uzziah was king of Judah and Jeroboam, son of Jehoash, was king of Israel." So if you were here, was it before Christmas when we were looking at the book of Isaiah? Amos is around that same sort of time, 760 BC-ish. And that era was a time of real economic prosperity for Israel. All Israel's traditional enemies had become weak. There were no big superpowers on the horizon. And so the capital of Israel, Jeroboam's capital, it was just oozing with luxury. Big building projects, luxury imported goods. There are some of these things that have been found in kind of archaeological digs, and it really obviously was. You know, in terms of that era, you know, it was just affluent, comfortable. Amos was from Tekoa, which was near Jerusalem, so right down in the south, in the southern kingdom. But God sent him to the north, to Israel, the northern kingdom. And throughout this prophecy of Amos, Amos speaks God's condemnation to the people of Israel. And in part, it's because even though the nation is affluent, the wealthy have got where they are by exploiting the poor. So in Amos 2 verse 6, they sell the innocent for silver, the needy for a pair of sandals. They trample on the heads of the poor as on the dust of the ground. Or on chapter 5 verse 11, you levy a straw tax on the poor and impose a tax on their grain.
And now in chapter 6, God speaks to the leaders in Israelite society. Woe to you who are complacent in Zion, to you who feel secure on Mount Samaria. What's the problem? What's all this complacency about? Verse 4, you lie on beds adorned with ivory and lounge on your couches. You dine on choice lambs and fatted calves. You strum away on your harps like David and improvise on musical instruments. You drink wine by the bowlful and use the finest lotions. A life of idle luxury. This is just the sort of thing that people who do the lottery are really hoping for, isn't it? All this was going on. But they were being complacent because Amos said, you do not grieve over the ruin of Joseph. Joseph, another word for Israel, God's people. And these people who were sort of leaders, amazingly affluent, comfortable, just were blind to the fact that their society was actually unraveling. That all this wealth they were enjoying was actually a sign that something was wrong, that they just couldn't see it. But even then, what is the problem? What's the problem with having choice lambs and fatted calves? I could go for that for my tea tonight. I'm not sure about drinking wine by the bowlful, but a glassful would be very nice. Yeah, what's the issue here? What's the problem with these people having this wealth? Is there something kind of automatically wrong with wealth? The problem seems to have been that the rich had made themselves richer, but at the same time the poor had become poorer. But I guess that most people in society would say that's just about inevitable. There will always be those who can get on, who can do well, who can sort of create wealth for themselves, and there'll be others who just don't do that. It's bound to happen. So why should God condemn his people because some of them had obviously become pretty affluent and done very nicely out of it? To answer that, I think we have to go further back in the Old Testament. Back into the Old Testament law. Let me start by going back to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 15. Deuteronomy is basically Moses' farewell sermon to God's people before they went into the promised land. It kind of draws together and highlights God's instructions, how society, the society of his people was supposed to function. So let me read Deuteronomy 15 and verse 1. At the end of every 7 years, you must cancel debts. This is how it's to be done. Every creditor shall cancel any loan they've made to a fellow Israelite. They shall not require payment from anyone among their own people, because the Lord's time for cancelling debts has been proclaimed. So they're about to go into the promised land. They're about to create this new society. And obviously from the start, that society was to be based on a system which creates equality. At the end of every 7 years, all debts cancelled. The aim of that, in verse 4, was, however, there need be no poor people among you. God promised that he'd bless his people as long as they obeyed him, which means, as with so many of God's promises to bless, that kind of blessing would come through his people. By obeying what he said and preventing one group of people becoming rich at the expense of another, all would be blessed. But then in verse 7, if anyone is poor among you, your fellow Israelites, you see, even though God had given these rules, he recognized that it still might be that someone would become poor. If that happened, the rest of the community had an obligation to help. They were to lend
to the person who'd become poor, which effectively, of course, meant that they were to give to him, because at the end of every 7 years, that debt would be written off. Give generously to them and do so without a grudging heart. Then, because of this, the Lord your God will bless you. But even then, straight after that, verse 11, God tells them, there will always be poor people in the land. No system could guarantee absolute equality. It was inevitable that some would fall into poverty. So God says, therefore I command you to be open-handed towards your fellow Israelites. So from the outset, God's blueprint for society was that systems should be in place to prevent a widening gap between rich and poor. When poverty did occur, people were commanded to provide for one another's needs. Now, actually, as I said, this is God's instructions to his people. But there's a kind of underlying principle there that actually God's manifesto would say that there need to be structures in place to prevent a widening gap between rich and poor. It actually went further than the cancellation of debts in the seventh year. If you've got your Bibles open, just turn back a few pages to Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus 25, let me read from verse 8. Count seven Sabbath years. The Sabbath year is that kind of seventh year that we just heard about. Count seven Sabbath years, seven times 7 years, so that the seventh Sabbath years, there's seven Sabbath years amount to a period of 49 years. Then sound the trumpet everywhere on the 10th day of the seventh month, on the Day of Atonement. Sound the trumpet throughout your land. Consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. Each of you is to return to your family property and to your own clan. The 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. Do not sow, do not reap what grows of its, reap what grows of itself or harvest the untended vines. For it is a jubilee. And it is to be holy for you. Eat only what is taken directly from the fields. In this year of jubilee, everyone is to return to their own property. Now, when the children of Israel went into the promised land, their land was shared out between the tribes, and then within the tribes, within the different clans, and then to each family. So you'll find, as you look at the book of Joshua, inordinate lists of names, because it's all to do with where each family was going to live. Each family had its own bit of land. And in every 50th year, everyone is to return to their ancestral home. So, imagine Fred Smith, or whatever the Old Testament Israelite equivalent would be, Zebulun Cohen or something like that. So, Fred Smith, he's come into the Promised Land, and he's a pretty shrewd, smart operator. By some good trading, bit of entrepreneurship, he starts to do really well. Now and again, he lends out some money. Usually he gets it back. But if he's lent to someone who can't pay it back at the end of 7 years, the debt's written off. But still, he's doing okay. After a while, Charlie Jones down the road has fallen on hard times. So Fred buys his land off him, and Charlie kind of becomes his servant. And so it goes on. The seventh year Sabbath stops Fred from becoming hugely rich. It stops other people from becoming desperately poor. But still, Fred's doing pretty well. His portfolio is expanding, his wealth's growing. And then comes the 50th year. Fred's done really well by now. He bought up lots of land around. But then in the 50th year, the year of Jubilee, Charlie, or his children if Charlie's dead, go back to their ancestral home. They get to go back, and they get that land back. Fred goes back to just having the bit of land his family got when they came to the promised land. Any debts he's owed are written off. Anyone who sold themselves to be his slaves are set free. The whole economic system is reset. There's actually no evidence in the Bible that it was ever actually implemented fully, even in Israel. But again, the point is that right from the start, God wrote into the instructions for the society which his people would form these systems for preventing the poor from continually becoming poorer or the rich continually becoming richer. And so when you get forwards hundreds of years into Amos' time, the rich were idling away on their beds adorned with ivory, whilst the poor were in deep poverty. And it wasn't just that, well, that's not really fair, in some abstract way. It actually went against God's purposes for his people. So how on earth does that apply to 21st century Britain? Well, I'm reasonably confident that it wouldn't be feasible for a party to put that into their manifesto. One of our manifesto pledges is that after 7 years, all the money that you've loaned will be written off. It's not going to be a vote winner. And anyway, as I said, this is God's instructions to his people. This isn't God's instructions to society generally. But it does highlight what I think God looks for in an economy, and what we should look for. And that is this kind of measure of equality. In the bishop's letter, it says, it's been widely observed that the greatest burdens of austerity have not been borne by those with the broadest shoulders, that is, those who enjoy a wide buffer zone before they fall into real need. Those whose margin of material security was always narrow have not been adequately protected from the impact of recession. Or, in other words, in Britain, material inequality continues to widen. Now, of course, it could be argued that actually, yeah, sort of equality is important and caring for the poor is important, but it's not actually the state's job to do this. The state can't change this situation. Actually, it's down to those who are rich using their wealth wisely to help the poor. That was certainly the view of those attending an event in London about 6 years ago. There was an event in London called the Fortune Forum. It was held at the Dorchester. It was attended by 100 billionaires. And one aim of the event was to provide governments to give these super rich people some tax breaks, so that they could give a bit more to charity. Now, I have to say, I read this story in the press about 6 years ago, and I thought it was a spoof, but it wasn't. But it kind of doesn't work, because it seems that whilst the poorest 20% of the population give 3% of their income to charity, the richest 20% of the population give just 0.8% of theirs. Now, of course, it's still big money, but proportionately it's so low. Now, there's a real danger of me standing here sounding grumpy old man-ish. And I'm sure that many of these wealthy people do see charity as important. It's just that there is this mindset that seems to be that they should be able to maintain their own comfortable lifestyle, and only after that will they have money to give away. Woe to you who are complacent in the Dorchester Hotel in London. You lie on beds adorned with ivory. You drink wine by the bowlful. That's almost certainly true. It's just the same, isn't it? God had put in place structural protection for the poor, and his people were ignoring it. One of the phrases that's often trotted out in church circles, and it actually appears in the bishop's letter, is that God has a bias to the poor. I actually think that's wrong. I don't think God has favorites. I don't think God's a biased God. But what I do see in the Bible is that God cares for the poor. He cares that they are poor, because any system of economic injustice just seems to go against what we know of God's character. And I think maybe the problem is that we live in a society which seems to be biased to the rich. And God is certainly against that. So, that's very basic, very quick. But what should we be doing about this? What does all this have to say to us here in Morton as we look forward to the general election? I think firstly, it is right for us to challenge political parties about what they would do to close the gap between rich and poor. It would have been really nice to have been able to ask our local candidates that on Friday evening. Only they won't turn up. And I think it's right, yeah. We don't have to impose our views on people, but we can certainly ask, what would you do to try to close that gap? But I think as well, if we want to speak about these issues, we need to be making sure that we are actually playing our part properly, that we're taking these issues seriously in our own lives. And now the likelihood is that we're all sitting here thinking, well, that's okay, because I'm not one of those billionaires. I'm probably not even millionaire rich. But actually, proportionally in terms of some of the rest of the world, we are wealthy. And so I think that it's a kind of challenge to us to make sure we take things like fair trade seriously. In the global economy, someone can be working on a banana plantation 5,000 miles away, and we could be benefiting from their poverty. We could be kind of guilty of indirect exploitation. And so we need, if we're going to challenge society about narrowing that gap between rich and poor, we have to play our part. And that means we need to be generous people. 20 years ago, it was calculated that if every Christian in the United States was to tithe, that would raise the amount of money theoretically needed to end world poverty. And it would still keep all the existing church work running. That's just if every Christian in America just tithed. And there's a real challenge to us to take the way that we use our money seriously and responsibly. And it isn't saying that we should give away everything we have and have nothing. It's actually saying that we need to look at what we've got, at what other key people have got, and that if we want to challenge society, we need to actually be showing what God's society would look like. People should be able to look at the church and see a sort of society, a community, which actually they recognize ought to be replicated in the world that we live in. Deuteronomy 15:11 said that we will always have the poor among us. But that doesn't mean that God is happy about that situation. And God's manifesto is for economic equality. And we need to be people who stand up for that, who speak up for that, but maybe most challengingly, who actually put that into practice in our own lives.